Mr. Black, Reel 4. You were mentioning that in the history of the regiment, that your family was involved in the very, hundreds of years ago.
Oh, yes, the 1700s, actually. It was a great-great-great-grandfather. He was Sir Cuthbert Heron. The Sir was questioned whether he sort of... it was one that he invented. We don't know. We can't really find out. But he was known, and I mean, there's been quite a lot in the local press about him. He did raise a company of volunteers in South Shields, round about the same time as the company was raised in Sunderland. According to history, they employed regular sergeants for to put them through the drill and musketry drill and this sort of thing. It was the time, I suppose, of the Napoleonic Wars, with the threat of the Napoleonic invasion. I have researched back to in the family history as far as him, but we haven't got any great detail of exactly what he does. I've got no doubt that in the local press, the Shields Gazette and the Newcastle Journal, there will be history of this particular chap, because from time to time they have published stories about him and about the Herons.
And these volunteers ultimately became 7th Battalion Durham Light Infantry.
Oh yes, through the years there was various, I suppose, voluntary units at time to time that were sort of mobilised and then stood down and. I do believe that quite a lot of them were sort of local gentlemen out of their own pockets, equipped these volunteers with uniforms and arms. And of course eventually it came through to the 7th DLI, of which the 47th DLI was one of the offshots. I think it was 1936 when they were invited by the War Office to become a searchlight regiment of the Royal Engineers.
And you retained, I think, Durham Light Infantry in the title, though, didn't you?
Right the way through, this was a very, very interesting point, because the title was the 47th Searchlight Battalion, RETADLI. Now, when the 47th Searchlight eventually became the 112 Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment, the title then was the 112 Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment, RATADLI.
So you retained Durham Light Infantry in the title.
The title was retained all the way through. And I don't know whether I mentioned this earlier on in the interview, but we were given permission for the sergeants and above for to wear the green lanyard of the DLIs instead of the white lanyard of the Royal Artillery. So we kept a connection with the DLI right well through the history of the regiment, at least while I was with it.
And what was the date in which you became Royal Artillery as a Royal Engineer?
Well, again, in 1940, instead of being invited to transfer to Royal Artillery, we were compulsory transferred to Royal Artillery. That was in August 1940.
Can we go back now to where we were before with the militia, in the militia huts? And we've talked at some length about your life there. Had you been issued with rifles?
Yes, this was the... We're defending the country. And our armament there consisted of 3 rifles per detachment. The detachment were 10 men, with 10 rounds of ammunition per rifle. We did have a Lewis gun, with I think we held about 2 pans as the of ammunition, plus not very much in the way of refill. That was for protection against aircraft.
And you would get no opportunity then to actually fire the weapons, did you?
We got to fire to periodic to a range. I mean, in the territorials, before we are called up, we quite often went to the range at Whitburn, the the range is still there and still very much used. Probably three or four times a year. And one of those occasions was a sort of weekend where you did all the firing. You fired the Lewis gun, you fired your rifles. There was ammunition for that, but the strange thing was, when we went on the site, there was such a scant supply of ammunition. I really don't know what would have done if anything had happened.
We've established, I think, that you were in the militia huts for 6 weeks, and then you moved out onto sites, or into another area.
We moved into another area.
Where did you go?
We moved from Easingwold area, and I was on the site at Aldwark. We moved up to Stokesley, around the Middlesbrough area, and we manned sites around there, right round Middlesbrough, Stockton, the ICI works, Hartlepool's, various sites all around the places. Some very, very lonely sites as well. I was on one for a very short period, which was known as the pneumonia site, because in the depth of that first winter, it was up at Cook's Monument, which was right on top of the Cleveland Hills. And literally, I mean, we had quite a lot of illness amongst the people man that, because, again, at the start, they were under canvas. They were in bell tents. We eventually moved from there to Sedgefield.
Now, before we move to Sedgefield, can you recall any of the other sites that you were on in the Middlesbrough Cleveland area?
Oh, yes. I was on one site for quite a while, was at Great Smeaton, on a farm at Great Smeaton. That, again, was out in the country, but there were principally manning the search sites for protection of the local aerodrome, which was Middleton St George in those days. Croft, there was a site there. East Cowton, there was a site. I've mentioned Carlton, that was in the Stokesley ones.
And these were all tented sites, were they?
At the beginning, we moved into tented sites. There were two bell tents on the site for the and a cooking facility. And it was the first one, as I say, was a really bad one.
And what are your memories of life in the middle of that winter?
Just that it was fairly hard, but we adapted to it. We weren't like quite a lot of the other units, you know, going into billets and having a sort of communal life. We were very much left on our own. We got probably a visit once a day from the then troop sergeant, the officer probably once every two or three days, the ration lorry each day, that came up each day. But we were self-contained, 10 men just away from, let's say, just under the, at that particular time, under the command of a lance corporal.
And you were all in one tent, is that the same?
Well, there was two tents. There was six. They were supposed to sleep up to 12 men in those bell tents, but if they did that, you hadn't room for anything else. No, we had two, and it was sort of five in each tent.
How were you able to keep your clothing and equipment off the damp ground? And
well, it was a great difficulty. You used to have a strap around the central pole where any gear you could hang up was hung up there. We had a big ground sheet on the on the bottom, and then of course we had our individual ground sheets. But it was quite a job keeping gear dry. Not only had to keep it dry, you had to keep it clean and polished up.
So that must have been difficult. You'd be in muddy fields, presumably.
We're in muddy fields, but that wasn't accepted as an excuse. I mean, from time to time, we used to have what they called a concentration, where you picked up your searchlight from that particular site and you moved to the section headquarters. That was each of the detachment moved in there, and they did concentration drills. They were practicing them for concentrating the searchlights rather than have them on individual sites. They had a concentration of three searchlights on one particular site. Eventually, the whole lot were concentrated in that way.
It was a kind of experimentation, was it?
It was an experiment. Plus, of course, it was an opportunity for drill with the troop sergeant and the officers and the instructors. Got the opportunity to instruct a group of men rather than just sort of 10 individuals on a site. It was training come experimentation. So.
What about sleep? Did you actually sleep on your ground sheet, or did you have a palias in the tent?
We had a palias. Each had a palias.
And what was the blanket issue for you?
The blanket issue was three blankets. You ended up with your greatcoat on top of the blankets, and that was frowned on at times. But never mind.
Was there any form of heating in the tent?
No heating in the tent. No, no. If you wanted warm, you went into the little cookhouse place. That's where I think I mentioned it earlier on about the Heath Robinson ovens that we had, the oil barrel with cow dung to insulate it.
And your cook, was he just someone selected from the tent?
He was literally, at the start, someone selected from the tent. They had very, very little training, as we knew to our sorrow when we first went away. In fact, on our site, we used to take turns in doing the basic cooking. Eventually, we did get a good cook who'd done a training course with the territorials, and it made a world of difference.
And the kind of food you were getting on the site, was it that just the same as you had been used to?
Oh yes. I mean, you got the meat and you got breakfast. You had the porridge and bacon and sausage occasionally. Tinned tomatoes. We used to either purchase eggs or we could scrounge them around the farm, because there was a lot of free range hens then that laid in various places, and we found out where they were laying, and you had those for your breakfast. The lunch or dinner was generally, it was a meat meal of some description. Occasionally stew or a roast or something like that with vegetables. Teas were normally sandwiches and a piece of what the term naffy cake. And night time, probably a mug of cocoa or something like that, and cheese and bread.
Was there a hot drink available right through the day in the middle of the
day? Oh, yes. I mean, you see, again, I come back to the fact that we were on our own. So, more or less, any time during the day, the cook would whip up a hot drink for you. And you needed it. And they were very, very good in that respect.
What was the distance between one detachment of 10 with a searchlight and probably the next one? What kind of distances are we talking about?
Well, as the crow flies, I mean, when I was on Great Smeaton site, the nearest site to us was Crofts Bar, and that was the distance of the crow flies, about 2 miles, and it was roughly 2 miles in between sites. Some probably a little bit closer to each other than that, but that was about the average.
And did you sleep in your clothing, as you intimated?
When we first went away, we were never out of our clothes for the first 6 weeks. We were on permanent stand to. And sleep, you didn't get an awful lot of that either, because with the number on there, there had to be two persons on duty. You had a ground sentry and an air sentry at that time. Well, out of, you can imagine, the cook didn't do any duties. The site commander, the lance corporal, didn't do a guard duty. So that it was 8 men left for to do that. So it was 2 hours on and 4 off, all through day and night.
Washing facilities on this little site on your own,
the washing facilities, there was a... was literally just a little lean-to shelter with big army zinc bowls in, and you got washed. If the cook was in a good mood, you got a Dixie of hot water for to get washed and shaved in. But or if he wasn't, he wanted it for the tea, you washed in cold water.
And the toilets, where were they? And
well, the toilets were always dug quite a distance away from the little camp. Again, just a hole in the ground with a shelter around it. At first, no great facility. I mean, if you wanted to use the toilet, you took a pickaxe with you, and you dug that into the ground, and you held on to that, and over a pit. Eventually, we did get some sort of a seating arrangement that.
If there was warning of a raid, did you have some form of communication with headquarters?
Oh yes, there was RT, which was radio telephone, which was in its infancy, and the RT set in the detachment was permanently switched on, and in touch with the section headquarters, and again section headquarters were in touch with the company headquarters, who were in touch with the regimental headquarters, and of course they received the warnings from the Observer Corps, whoever, that a raid was anticipated in some way, and you got the warning over the RT to stand by, and then when that happened, everyone turned out and manned the searchlight. You had to report in every hour on the RTD section headquarters.
You didn't have a permanent or fixed time for stand to, as the infantry had.
We didn't. As I say, it was more or less permanent stand to. There was someone on duty the whole time.
Yeah. In those very early days, whilst you were in this area that we're talking about. Around Cleveland, Middlesbrough area. Did you have any activity? Do you recall any activity against enemy aircraft?
Oh yes, there was quite a few aircraft came across. We didn't have any that at the very beginning. No great bombing raids or anything like that. But I mean, there was the planes came across or the spotting or something like that, and we quite often had to turn out and. When this plane came across, because a lot of them in those days, of course, were just unidentified aircraft. We hadn't got the sophisticated gear that they had later on, where the our own planes could identify themselves. There was a system fairly early on where we got the what they used to call the fruit. It was. Just a code for the day of identification. At the if we picked up a plane, and it was one of our own, he flashed a certain code. I don't think we would have ever been able to pick it up properly. I honestly had no experience of seeing a plane flash a code. I know at times we used to get reports back about those so-and-sos on the lights. Put that beam right on me.
And do you recall any time when you actually did get a beam on an enemy aircraft?
Oh, yes, down at... it was a little bit later than what we're talking about here. We're down at Seton Carew.
We'll come to that when we...
When you come on here. No, this particular time, I can't recall a time when we... when we picked a plane up.
The daily routine on this site, out in the wires, wherever you were, was it much the same as you'd been used to in when you were in the militia hut area?
Well, you see, in the militia hut area, although it was a hut, it was virtually the same as the tented site. We were still isolated, still 10 of us on our own, and the routine was more or less the same as that. I mean. Fairly early reveille, breakfast, PT, maintenance of equipment, and then instruction on whatever your job was. And occasionally we had people come from the company headquarters and took such things as map reading and gas drill, these sort of things. And also periodically there was a team used to come out from headquarters for to supervise heavy maintenance.
Was it a boring life in time as time went over?
We found plenty to sort of keep ourselves busy. I suppose in today's terms it really was boring. I mean, you hadn't much to do at night time other than sit, you sort of sat in the hut with an oil lamp or a candle or something, and you just read or played cards or something like that.
And in a tent, what kind of lighting did you have in the tent?
The tent, we just had the hurricane lamps.
And this went on for quite a number of weeks, of course.
Well, we're in a tented accommodation from about the end of October 1939. We eventually got a wooden hut on the site about April 1940.
So the whole of the winter,
we were in that time.
How bad did it get, really, the winter?
Well, 1940 was a really bad winter. I mean, we had snow. I mean, it was nothing to get up in the morning and have to brush the snow off your tent.
And you'd have to keep it off the searchlight, I suppose.
There was a big cover for the they were covered up more or less permanently. The same with the sound locator. There's a big cover there. The first thing you did when you got a stand to was, of course, whip the covers off and that. But they were covered up.
How deep did the snow get at its worst?
I wouldn't say it was. It was particularly deep. I mean, if you had 6 inches to a foot, probably.
So you didn't get cut off from your.
Oh, we didn't get cut off. I mean, the Russian lorries, as far as I ever remember, always managed to get through to the site.
At what point were the changes in the personnel? I think some of the older ones were moved out, and these young immatures came in.
Well, that was, again, that was getting about to the 1940s, probably about, I should think about May 1940 when we first got our first militiaman, as he was then, or the 1600s of renewal, because the number all began with 1-6.
Where were they coming from?
All over. I mean, we had quite a lot of people came up from Yorkshire. But I mean, they came from the Midlands, from Gloucester, from London. We had all sorts of people eventually joined us.
So you lost the Durham influence to a degree.
Just to a degree. I mean, we kept that influence, I think, fairly well right through the war, because there was always more of the originals than there was of the intakes.
How did they settle?
Some of them badly, some of them quite well. In my own experience, I mean, they were really welcomed into the detail. I mean, there was no standoff between the people from up here who were originally in the regiment and the people who came into it. But some of them didn't take it very, very well. In fact, there's one case when we're in the... I don't know whether you want this, because it's a little bit after, not long after we're on the site, we moved to another concentrated site, and there was a chap joined us. He was a likeable fella. I mean, I got on very, very well with him, but he just couldn't stand it. And one night I was on guard duty outside, and I heard this shot. And I investigated, and I found him in the ablutions, and he'd shot himself.
And dead, was he?
Dead, yes.
Mm-hmm. As if you get in a small group of 10 who are getting on well, and you get an influx of one or two who may not, it could have an effect on the group.
Well, our own group, no. I mean, we had one lad came from Staffordshire. I remember him pretty well, Cosner Lawton, because he always the Staffordshire Irish was a Cosner. We really got on, and another chap from London, J.J. Bruce, he also became a site mascot. So I don't honestly remember anything that where there's anything untoward to these people who joined us.
Again, in the winter conditions, did you get on? You were still getting on well with the farmers around you, and
we got on quite well with the farmers. I mean, that was the beauty on the great smeaton site. We had a lovely chap there. In fact, again, they became lifelong friends. I mean, unfortunately, his life wasn't very long after the war, but with his family, we were welcomed into the house at night time when we weren't on duty, and were glad of the warmth, and played cards and darts with him and with his farm hands, and quite often had a supper with them.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Tom Neeson.
And his farm, he was a farm, you see?
He was a farm.
Do you remember the name of the farm?
Stone Riggs Farm. We used to visit it quite often after the war. Of course, he was always banging on about the damage that the lorry was doing to his field. But as I think I said earlier, that was between him and the people responsible. Taking a lorry in and out twice a week for what concentration at the section headquarters, obviously it tore up the field. I mean, a 3-ton lorry, it does a bit of especially on the snowy weather or rainy weather when the ground was soft and just churned it up.
Did you cooperate with the local RAF stations, fighter stations, or the local guns?
We weren't actually in cooperation with them, but I mean headquarters were. I mean, there was liaison between the regiment. I mean, there was liaison officer with the aerodromes, etc. So we could get the information about what was happening. I mean, you used to get the information about probably a bomber raid coming in or going out, so that you wouldn't sort of expose beams.
I think you've intimated, really, was it really difficult using a searchlight and identifying an enemy or a British aircraft in the early days?
Well, it was in the early days. That's when we had the term IFF, identification friend or foe, and it was most difficult. I mean, we wouldn't have dared say that at the time, but I mean, looking back, it was Heath Robinson.